This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Joel Bourne grew up down the road from his family farm in eastern North Carolina. At the end of the Green Revolution, during the mid-20th century, scientists had figured out how to genetically modify wheat and rice to produce a stronger and more efficient crop. The result was an agricultural boom. Worldwide grain production tripled thanks to high-yield crops. It was the answer to a growing crisis of food scarcity. But it also meant that we would need more water, more fertilizer, and more pesticides. Joel immediately noticed the strong connection between food and the environment, and it thrust him into a career as a nature reporter. Since he left Tarboro, North Carolina, Joel has covered some of the top environmental stories in the country, from the devastation of Hurricane Katrina to the Gulf oil spill. And now he has returned to the subject of food scarcity. His new book is called The End of Plenty, and it examines the history of how we've produced food and the challenges of keeping up with an ever-growing population. Joel Bourne has written for Mother Earth News, Defenders of Wildlife, and today contributes to National Geographic and is my guest on The State of Things. Joel Bourne, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about growing up in Tarboro in the 1960s and 70s, right?
That's right. I was born in 62, and a great place to grow up, wonderful little small town. My grandfather had a farm in the county. He was a small town attorney and loved to bird hunt. He was a fanatic hunter and fisherman. And so he acquired this farm in the 30s. And as I grew up, my father loved it as well. And we grew up working on the farm, cleaning up after it, planting wildlife plots, you know, mowing pastures.
Wildlife plots. So it wasn't all crops. What kind of, well, I'll ask you about the crops, but the wildlife part intrigues me at the moment.
Oh, sure. Well, it was a typical eastern North Carolina farm. So we grew tobacco, corn, soybeans, and cotton. But we had all these beautiful hardwood sloughs that fed down to the Tar River. And so this is where my friends and I would take our old bird dogs and go look for quail or hunt squirrels in the woods. It was a really wonderful, it's almost like having a park, you know, that it was all yours that you could just get turned loose on every Saturday after you did your chores. It was a wonderful place to grow up.
What about the crops? What were you growing?
Well, like I said, we had tobacco, cotton, peanuts, soybeans, wheat. It was very diversified. My dad always kept a few cows. Did not farm himself. He rented it out to tenant farmers, but they were almost like kind uncles to me. And, you know, every now and then when my dad didn't think I was working hard enough, he'd send me out there to go work in tobacco or chop peanuts or chop cotton with a hoe. And I was out there with a lot of the little African-American children who lived on the farm and worked there as well. So it was a very interesting way to grow up. But a lot of my friends did, too, worked in either tobacco or cucumbers.
Things had changed a lot in the farm industry from the 1930s when your grandfather bought that land to when you were working on the land, right, in terms of how you – what it meant to be a farmer.
Sure. And I was growing up during this tremendous change that occurred right around 1972. And this was when Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz made this huge sale of wheat to Russia and decided that the American farmer was going to feed the world. So up until that point, farming had been largely a family affair. But now everyone was encouraged to plant fence row to fence row. The American farmer was going to go from families to agribusiness, and the American farmer was going to feed the world. And so that's the kind of paradigm that I grew up in.
And this fence row to fence row philosophy, which really sort of got its momentum earlier, and I think actually began right after World War II, as the farming was shifting from pretty much an organic style of crop rotation was a requirement in order not to exhaust the soil. You still need farm animals around to provide fertilizer. And so, first of all, you really couldn't take a vacation because you had farm animals. And the way you planted monoculture was unheard of. The idea of growing one crop, you know, on all those fields. So this was a big change in terms of how farming was done. Produced some enormous yields, right?
Enormous yields. I mean, the Green Revolution virtually nearly tripled grain yields, sort of these basic staple grain yields from the 1950s, when about a third of the world's population was hungry, chronically hungry, to about what we have today, 12% of the world's population, even though we've had tremendous population growth in the meantime. So we were able to generally keep everyone fed. And it was such an enormous event, not only in reducing poverty, but in reducing hunger, that the man who is considered the father of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, the only agricultural scientist ever to win that award.
So this is the air you're breathing, the ground on which you walk. You're in the midst of this revolution that everyone is obviously, this is great, we're going to feed the world. And so I want to leave you there on the farm and in that moment in the development of agricultural technology and talk about you personally and your plans. What were you thinking for yourself growing up? What were your career plans?
To me, it was my destiny to be a farmer. I just loved being on the farm. I loved working on the farm. I loved playing on the farm. To me, it was one of the most beautiful places on the planet. I love the way it smelled, walking down the dirt paths at the end of the day and hearing a quail call in the woods. It was a wonderful, wonderful existence. And so when I graduated from high school, I applied to one university, NC State, in their agronomy program. And, just thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
You went there, you graduated, right? Got a BS in agronomy from NC State. You're well on your way to a farming career. And then something about journalism grabbed hold, huh?
Well, I had a catharsis like I think many students do. I was about in my junior year at NC State, and I was taking an entomology class. And it was taught by a senior professor who'd been there many years, and he had this penchant for going off on tangents. And one day somebody asked him about DDT. And his response, I'll never forget, he's like, best chemical ever invented. Rachel Carson was just a kook. There was absolutely no scientific basis for that book at all. So I raised my hand in the back because, I did a lot of fishing on the coast when I was a kid, and I remember seeing my first brown pelican come back and the first time I ever saw an osprey or an eagle nesting on Pamlico Sound. So I raised my hand in the back and I said, well, why are we just now seeing these great fish hawks and the pelicans coming back to the coast a decade after we banned DDT? And he looked at me as if I just spat in his coffee and said, wildlife, it's all cyclical. And I thought it was common knowledge that DDT had caused eggshell thinning and caused populations to plummet. And so it really, the sort of scales had fallen from my eyes. I'd been getting grown more and more concerned about the chemical nature of agriculture, what they were trying to teach me there. I'd asked some of my professors about organic farming, and they would always say, and these were men I greatly respected, I have utmost respect for, and they would say, great for your garden, but it'll never feed the world. And so by the time I got out of NC State, the great plow up that occurred during the Earl Butch years had depressed farm prices to almost rock bottom. Things were going so bad at home. I mean, that Willie Nelson, John Cougar, mm-hmm. and Neil Young staged their first Farm Aid concert the year I graduated. The best farmers in the county that I knew personally were going bankrupt. If I wanted to go back and farm, I would have had to go to the bank and borrow a bunch of money to buy equipment and, pay rent to my dad and my uncle. And at that point, I'd been taking journalism classes under Rod Cox at NC State and a writing class under Lee Smith. Couldn't believe anybody would get paid to have that much fun. It was just a blast, and I did well and excelled in it. And so I thought, I'll try this for a while and see. And I can always, if I want to go back to farming, I can try that later.
Well, it's interesting to think about what happened and why the bottom fell out. The idea that really farmland, the farm was the last sort of in the industrial economy to feel the speed up. Right? Everybody in heavy mechanical and heavy engineering and heavy industry had felt the speed up. You had to work faster and faster and more just to keep pace. And now it was happening in farming. So great, huge yields. What was that due to the price?
Yeah, bottomed out.
Bottoms out.
Totally bottomed out.
So what does that mean? Then the old joke about you make it up in volume actually isn't funny anymore. So economies of scale in farming become huge. You've got to have a huge farm in order to get any kind of economy of scale, pennies on the bushel, which meant small farmers were being kicked out. And we finally industrialized and commodified the last acre of farmland.
Absolutely. And not just, from the economic, it was economic devastation on many of the farms. That's just when PBS and NPR were doing series on young farm couples who were just struggling to make ends out in the Midwest. But also it was an enormous environmental toll. I went from finding about five or six coveys a day you know, walking around the farm. And then all the hedgerows got plowed up, all the edges got plowed away, all the habitat sort of got, you know, the cattle pastures, everything got plowed, you know, until I couldn't barely find but one. And I asked one of the scientists at NC State, what was going on with the quail population? And he said, well, the pesticides we now use on cotton either kill the birds outright, weaken their immune systems, or so reduce the number of insects in the field that the baby quail chicks can't find enough to eat. So I was thinking, wow, well, this type of agriculture is not, it's not really the type that I want to practice.
And it was having an impact on the farm itself. Those pesticides and herbicides required far more water for farming, right?
Well, water has been an enormous issue. We're just seeing it in North Carolina if we've had a few years of drought. We're much luckier here because we get 48 inches of rain on average every year. But when you start to look at water withdrawal in places like the Midwest that are dependent on these ancient underground aquifers, or in California where they're dependent on snowmelt from the Colorados and the Sierra Nevada, and see how climate change is starting to affect their agriculture. Because you can have the best farmers, the best soils, the best seed, the best technology in the world. If you don't have enough water, you don't have squat.
I'm talking to nature reporter and National Geographic contributor Joel Bourne. His latest book is called The End of Plenty. Our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Joel Bourne, a nature reporter, contributing writer for National Geographic. Just written a new book on food scarcity called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times the Green Revolution. In many ways, there is one man at the center of it, although obviously a lot of dynamics contributed. But tell us more about Norman Borlaug.
Sure. Norman Borlaug was a plant pathologist, someone who deals with plant diseases. He grew up on a hardscrabble farm in Iowa, went to the University of Minnesota. Got his PhD under a very famous researcher at the time named Elvin Stakeman, who was the wheat rust specialist for the United States.
And wheat rust is?
A horrible disease of wheat that decimated crops in the United States during World War I and created a huge food security issue, historic one back then. And so Elvin Stakeman had this big lab at the University of Minnesota where he fought and eliminated much of the wheat rust in the Midwest. So he saw this Borlaug kid, tough farm kid, not in class, but on the wrestling team. And he was a great judge of character. Borlaug wasn't the best student, but he was tenacious. And I think he got to the national championships or district level, even though he wasn't the greatest wrestler, just because he was so bloody tough. Much later, about the same time, Stakeman was asked by the head of the Rockefeller Foundation, who was himself asked by the vice president, Henry Wallace, to go do something about Mexico, help Mexico, because Mexico was becoming increasingly dependent on U.S. Imports of wheat to feed their people. They were having awful wheat rust epidemics down there. And so the Rockefeller Foundation set up a agricultural experiment station down in Mexico to try to help to feed it. Borlaug was one of the scientists that Stakeman recruited to go run it. And he was the wheat specialist. So to make a very long and complicated short, within 10 years, Borlaug had eliminated wheat rust in Mexico. And to this day, the vast majority of our rust resistance came from genes that Norman Borlaug developed.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, because you said it was his professor in Minnesota who had developed some of the techniques that seemed to wipe it out in the U.S. How is what he encountered in Mexico different, and what did he do that brought us to the next generation?
Stakeman found that burberry was a host plant for rust. So he basically eradicated with this huge burberry eradication program, like we had the boll weevil eradication program in the 1920s, and was able to control the United States. Of course, Borlaug found genetic cultivars that were naturally resistant to rust, and he bred them into the Mexican wheat cultivars to give them inherent resistance. Now, this is traditional Mendelian breeding. This is not GMO technology. He's crossing thousands of different species, weeding out the chaff, and getting, you know, the few that work. Within 10 years, he was able to defeat wheat rust, and the suite of genes that he developed is the basis of most wheat rust resistance around the world, still today. So it was a phenomenal thing. But then he went a step further and said, you know what? Wheat was at one time a tall, wispy plant. And he said, well, look, we're able to get some really high yields here. He was working with yields as well. But the wheat's falling over. It's lodging. And when it lodges, it rots, and we can't really harvest it. We need a tough stalk for that wheat to hold that head up. And he found one, oddly enough, was part of the in a Japanese lab that was taken over by MacArthur's Army of Occupation after World War II. This tiny little plant, it was a dwarf wheat variety that Borlaug eventually, through various other researchers, was able to breed into the wheats in Mexico and create this tiny dwarf wheat that stood up and yielded like crazy.
Sure, because in part, not only is it not bending over and rotting, but it's just there are fewer cells to feed, right? I mean, it's smaller wheat. So.
It put all its energy into the seed head, and it took up nitrogen fertilizer like nobody's business and water. So it was this enormously high-yielding thing. And to put that in perspective, it took like, 10,000 years for farmers to grow, you know, get wheat yields up to 1 ton. 1 ton per hectare. You know, Borlaug went from 1 to 6 in 40.
Wow. And with sort of more conventional kinds of crossbreeding techniques.
Yes. Absolutely.
Not laboratory. Yeah. GMO. So, and there, the stories in the book about getting him, what happens to him when he gets to Mexico and how crazy the local farmers think he is and what he has to go through to get it all started is, they're pretty amazing. But you just said something a second ago about the nitrogen uptake and the water uptake. This becomes, the yields are high, but also the cost is high for producing this.
Cost is enormously high, both in terms of water use, because, again, people often associate Borlaug's green revolution, what it became to be called, with these high-yielding varieties, lots of chemicals, fertilizer as well as chemical pesticides. But one of the great secrets to Borlaug's success was irrigation. The two areas that he used were heavily irrigated, and the areas where the green revolution has had its greatest success has not been in dryland farming. It has been in the great irrigated breadbaskets of the world. So water demand was a crucial part of the Green Revolution and remains so in terms of intensifying agriculture today, because you can typically get 2 to 3 times the yield if you always have a continuous supply of water versus rain-fed.
And these other industries producing nitrogen and producing fertilizers and pesticides is, in many ways, an energy-intensive business.
Tremendous.
To produce this stuff.
Tremendously. I mean, if you think about it in terms of global climate change or global emissions, all the various industries and costs associated with the Green Revolution, with agriculture at large, emits 30% of all human-induced emissions. So that's from cutting down forests to the energy inherent in making nitrogen fertilizer now, which is now derived from natural gas.
And we're not noticing all these costs because we're dazzled by the yields. And we're worried. The problem going in was that we can't feed ourselves or we can't feed the world. So you solve that problem and we're not noticing the intensity, the energy intensity, the loss of habitat, the cost of the environment, and ultimate cost down the line, because that's not what we're looking. That's not the problem right now, right?
That's right. Well, and to a certain extent, Borlaug was so successful in increasing yields around the world. You know, I mean, we eat, you know, there are 50,000 edible plants. Three, you know, wheat, rice, and corn produce the vast majority of all the calories, either directly or indirectly, that humanity consumes. Rice alone, you know, provides the bulk of the calories for half the world's population. Borlaug was so successful in making these staple grains so readily available that we stopped investing in agriculture. You know, we stopped investing in basic research that would keep those yields climbing. And even Borlaug himself said, you know, we've got about 30 years. The Green Revolution has given us 30 years of breathing room in order to get sort of these population demand issues sort of in line with our yield issues. You know, otherwise we're going to be right back where we started. And sure enough, in 2000, 30 years after Borlaug said this, we started to see yields declining or flattening out all around the globe. So even though corn is the only yield, and this is feed corn primarily, is the only one that's kept going up. Wheat, 1% or less. Rice, our yields are virtually flatlined in the great rice-growing regions of the world. So as the Green Revolution is petering out and stalling, demands are just starting to go through the roof.
Well, and the costs are going up as well, and those lines have already crossed in some industries, and we haven't even talked about soil erosion because, again, the idea that I now have to plant all of my acres in soybeans where the money is, I can now because it used to be a big risk to have all of your crop, all of your seeds in one crop if one infestation would wipe you out. Well, if I have pesticides that kill all those bugs, I can plant everything in soybeans. We're exhausting the soil because of that. Because we don't do crop rotation, let fields go fallow at rates, and the soil loss in the Midwest is just an enormous problem.
It's tremendous, and this is, you know, it's not just as we face this rising demand, we're looking at constraints on several fronts. Soil certainly is the most important one. I mean, we subsist on 6 inches of topsoil, the whole world, everyone around the world, you know, and it does not come back at timescales that are even remotely meaningful to us. Soil is created on geologic time, not in human time. Water is an enormous constraint. Arable land. We're losing the size of the Philippines every year in arable land through development, salinization, you know, just plowing it under. So all these things are becoming a hard line. If we don't have some sort of yield increase or get a hold of our demand, you know, some scientists have suggested we're going to have to plow under another 1.5 billion more hectares. Yeah. I mean, it's just insane. And that's going to come from tropical rainforests, tropical savannas, places you really, really don't want to lose.
Well, again, and if technology is the answer, I mean, the unintended consequences of that should by now be pretty evident to us. So relying on more technology that got us here to be the answer, yeah. I'm not sure. And the other thing is, one of the great promises is that we're going to feed a lot more people. And for one brief moment through the 60s and 70s and here in Mexico and India, certainly the Green Revolution, that was true. But we're now getting back to the point. I think the United States, well, I read it in your book. Now we're actually consuming more than we produce in the United States. We're coming perilously close
around,
to that.
Yeah, around the world. Look, when you look at global figures, now, you know, it always goes up and down, typically year. But, you know, in the 70s, I think we consumed or utilized more grain than we grew in about 3 years out of 10. The 80s were fairly dry, so it was about 5 years out of 10. 90s were back to 4 years out of 10. Since 2000, we've consumed or otherwise utilized through biofuels and other industrial processes more grain than we've consumed in 8 out of the first 12 years. So again, there's this imbalance where demand is slowly outstripping supply.
Well, I want to get back to your career because you do switch to journalism after hearing a professor tell you that Silent Spring was just a lot of kooky nonsense. So to talk about that, you went to college, then you went to Columbia for journalism school?
I did. After I got out of NC State, I started working on various small papers around the coast. I got my first job down at the Maritimes, a great little free weekly paper published out of Morehead City. Was an enormous amount of fun. And worked a little bit with Spectator during the wintertime.
What kind of stories were you reporting with the Maritimes?
Oh, everything. You know, I spent a lot of time down in Carteret County when I was a kid, fishing and going out to Cape Lookout with my dad and granddad. You know, so I would interview boat builders on Harkers Island, who I loved, all the old fishermen. But one day I did a story on that generated out of the Duke Marine Lab. On the Albemarle-Pamlico estuarine study, the APE study. And it was run by this great, wonderful marine biologist named Dr. Koslow, who was head of the marine science program down there. And it kind of opened my eyes to this whole field of environmental journalism because he said, you know, we've had these enormous corporate farms move in to eastern North Carolina during the 80s. They've plowed up so much of this land and put in so much fertilizer that we're seeing all this runoff into the estuary that's taking out the seagrass beds. You know, the sediment and these other things. Plus, we're seeing these great algal blooms coming in. So, you know, what this study was trying to do was create a baseline of, you know, what's here, what we've got, what we're losing, and what some of the controls were. Fascinating stuff. Biggest story I'd ever written. And I was just entranced by this idea of this relationship between human activity and the natural world that I loved and spent the bulk of my time in. And that sort of really got me going into the field of environmental journalism.
Well, and again, looking, if you only look upstream at the yields and some of the money that maybe now big corporate farms can make, it looks pretty good. Then as you follow the waste downstream, that's when you see where the costs are. And so people at the other end of that are bearing
absolutely
costs.
And of course, the corporate farms in eastern North Carolina were a classic cautionary tale. The one that is now the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge was basically a tax dodge for a large insurance company. You know, they were gonna have a tax write-off, have nice deer hunting for their people, and then, you know, write it off on their taxes. They didn't really need to make money. And they thought, oh, the soil's black. It must be incredibly fertile. Well, it wasn't. And it was under sea level, so they had to spend a lot of money to keep it pumped out. It was a boondoggle from the get-go, and now it's a very beautiful wildlife refuge.
So you're reporting on all these great stories, large and small, but down there at Carteret County, the Maritimes was the name of the paper. Then you decide maybe I should get a little formal training, go to Columbia.
Right? That's right. Yeah, I kept turning pieces in, and the editors would go, "It's fine. It's fine. It's fine." And I thought, well, you know, it's not fine. If I'm going to make a career out of this, I really need a little more, you know, it had to be a little bit better than, okay, it's on time. So I applied just on a whim to Columbia Journalism School. Somebody had said that that was one of the best ones in the country. And I got in. I was completely shocked. And I figured out much later they must have sort of a redneck quota where they, you know, Columbia takes one redneck a year. And it was really interesting. My first day there was sitting in the World Room, you know, which was Joe Pulitzer's, named after Pulitzer's paper, and his big symbol is on the ceiling. And they go around and start asking everybody what their journalism experience was. And, you know, my friend to my right had worked as an intern for the New York Times. The guy to the left had been at the Washington Post. Somebody else had worked on the Today Show. And I thought, oh, good Lord. When it came to my turn, I said, well, most recently I was the field editor for Rice Journal, The Peanut Farmer, and the Flu-Cured Tobacco Farmer magazines, to the no end of ribbing and guffaws in the end of the room. But in reality, that, you know, my background in agricultural science has served me incredibly well. I mean, it's this combination of plant science, soil science, and a wonderful sort of look at ag economics. It sort of gives you a great overview about how, you know, this human endeavor, which now covers 40% of the dry land on Earth, really affects the society. And so while I was at Columbia, I did a fisheries story for my master's. I profiled the Long Island lobster industry, of which there is none no more because of the rising temperatures in Long Island Sound. And it really gave me this wonderful perspective on how humans interact with their environment.
Well, you also then went back to your farm in Edgecombe County for a while and had another experience with pesticides, right?
Yeah. Well, I kept matriculating back to the farm because, you know, as a freelancer, you know, sometimes you do well and sometimes you need to go back to the farm and regroup. And, my wife and I got married and we moved back to the farm in 1997. And when she got pregnant with my first son, we were living in this little one-room, one-bedroom cabin on the farm and having a wonderful time. But the farmer that we ran out to was growing cotton and right behind the house. And they were spraying it with, you know, aerial crop dusters. And so I talked my dad and the farmer into just letting me try 5 acres. It wouldn't be technically organic because you need 3 years to set it aside. But I said, let's just try 3 acres of cotton and not spray it and not put any pesticide on it and just see how it does. So I thought, wow, this is going to be a really great way to show these very traditional farmers that you can at least make a crop with this type of agriculture. So we planted the cotton. And I had hooked up plows to one of our old tractors, and I would plow it the traditional way, not with spraying. And we got a good yield that came up that was fairly quickly, within a month, overtaken by pigweed, which was one of our endemic weeds on the farm. Mm-hmm. And try as I might, I just could not keep ahead of the pigweed. So it didn't, as an experiment, it was probably, it did not sway many minds because the pigweed pretty much took it over.
Right.
But as a it was a wonderful buffer zone, you know, to keep the chemicals a little further away from the house.
And, of course, there are techniques when you get to a larger scale that can use some natural enemies and that sort of thing.
Oh, sure. Well, and also the first year is always the worst. Yeah. I mean, I think any organic farmer will probably tell you that the transition, the first 3 years, it takes a while before you get some sort of balance between the pests and the crop you're trying to grow.
How'd you get to the National Geographic?
Well, at that point, I had been writing, doing a lot of freelancing for Audubon and had done some pieces for Science and the World Resources Institute. And I had a friend who was a map maker at Geographic. And within 6 months after my son was born, he gave me a call and said, look, they're looking for a staff writer. I think you'd be great. Why don't you apply? And at that point, the way you got onto National Geographic was they would give you what they called the little legends test. So they give you a layout of all the photos and the text, but with no captions. And your assignment is to write all the captions, which at that point were extremely important to National Geographic. And then you turn it in, and it was a blind test so that nobody was given any favoritism. They liked my test.
You did it. You did it.
And they called me up.
Well, and especially if you're in TV, really, kind of that's all you're doing. So when it got to National Geographic TV, it's kind of all captions. Joel Bourne is my guest. Career as a nature reporter and environmental reporter. His latest book is called The End of Plenty, and our conversation will continue in a few moments. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. My guest this hour, North Carolina native Joel Bourne, made a living as a nature and wildlife reporter for Mother Earth News, Defenders of the Wildlife, and now contributing writer for National Geographic. His new book is called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. We talked about working for National Geographic, doing some writing for them. You were there, and I guess you started working in 2000. Hurricane Katrina hit 2005, and you were sent to Louisiana. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I went down before in 2004. I had done a piece in Science and at Defenders on the rapidly diminishing loss of wetlands in Louisiana, which had the fastest rate of wetland loss in the country, if not the world. Southern Louisiana, south of I-10, used to be virtually all wetland. It's this beautiful, I call it the working marsh, because it provides enormous amount of resources for the United States. But they've sliced it up. The oil and gas industry cut canals through it willy-nilly when they went out in the 1940s and discovered oil offshore in Louisiana. They've changed the hydrology. We've slammed the Mississippi and put it in dikes so it doesn't spill over and replenish anymore. So it's starved of nutrients and sediment. Plus all of the oil and gas offshore that's being pulled out has, some believe, caused subsidence, caused the underground sediments to sink, all of which put New Orleans closer and closer and closer to the Gulf. So I went down there and talked to many people about the risks of the city with its sort of dilapidated pumps and its old levee system toward a major hurricane. And their big fear was, of course, of Category 5 with a direct hit south of the city. And so I had written this lead that was a sort of conjecture of a possible storm flooding the city, hitting the city of New Orleans. 10 months later, after I'd written this huge sort of imaginary disaster scenario as my lead, Hurricane Katrina slammed into the city and devastated it. It was one of the most tragic disasters. I think, it's a shame because, we have such a short attention span. It's been 10 years since Katrina. Mm-hmm. The city still hasn't fully recovered from what it was pre-Katrina-wise. There's still a diaspora of folks that are sort of surround the city. People have moved out of the southern parishes north of the lake to try to save what they have left. It's an American tragedy.
Right. Well, that story that you wrote for National Geographic and inherent in this new book of yours, The End of Plenty, is this kind of public policy conundrum that we face. The policies, you talk about carving up the wetlands and sort of what this means for American resources in the region. Well, if you're talking about all of our resources, how do we make decisions about how best to use that? And corporations can go in and extract the wealth, the pennies on the dollar, the way we set up our lease system, we get very little. You keep calling it American oil. Are you kidding? It's not mine. It belongs to BP. So, but this is kind of the problem, the tragedy of the commons. It's all of ours, and yet how do we focus our attention on the wetlands of Louisiana that really are vital to our sustenance when, you know, corporations have figured out how to get experts down there and lobby, and they've got the wealth to do this.
Well, you know, this is the thing, Frank, and I've come to – now it's become so common in my reporting on various stories that I've come to look for this. In almost every case – whether it's lead in gasoline, whether it's the Columbia River salmon and the impact of dams, you know, whether it's the impact of DDT and other chemicals, there has always been one researcher crying in the wilderness who gets it and who gets it right and who predicts the outcome. And it was the same case in Katrina. I talked to scores of scientists who said it's not if, but when. Unless we don't get the levees up, unless we don't fix the pumps and the canals, we're going to get whacked. And so it was common knowledge. Unfortunately, our society is reactive. We're not proactive. The scary thing now, though, to me, and this is one of my compelling reasons for writing this book, was that I'm hearing that same thing amongst very practical, level-headed agricultural scientists who are saying if we don't get this climate change issue under control, then we are risking putting hundreds of millions of people at risk of starvation, you know, of flooding. I mean, people worry about superstorms like Sandy. The greatest impact climate change is going to have on our world is our ability to feed ourselves and future generations.
Well, then talk about that, because you document that in the book, how fast we're losing arable land owing to fossil-driven climate change.
Well, here, the study that really blew my mind came out a couple of years ago from the Royal Society. This was the same group that, you know, that Malthus was a member of, one of the most prestigious scientific organizations on the planet. And basically, they did this huge wide look of various climate change studies and models and said, if our global average temperature gets to 4 degrees above what we are now, above average, we could potentially lose half of our arable land, half of our farmland that's currently being farmed will no longer be suitable for agriculture. Half of our land. And this is a time when we're supposed to be doubling our production by 2050 to keep up with population growth and increased demand from our increasing wealth and meat-centric diets. The numbers just don't add up. And yet we're currently on the path to hit between 3.5 and 5.3 degrees Celsius by 2100. So that's the figure that scares me to death.
Here's the thing, though. This brings us back to Malthus, where this conversation began. And, of course, he's been, in many circles, discredited. It didn't happen the way he said it would. Of course, he didn't really say we were going to get there. He just said, if you thread out these numbers, it doesn't look good. Famously, he has a debate with David Ricardo, the free market economist of the time, who said, look, unlimited growth will lead to dynamic change in the economy. Technological developments that are going to solve your problem, Mr. Malthus. So it looks bad now, but if you let my economy go, we will technologically fix the problem that you're predicting. Why can't I say that to you right now? That what you're predicting now, if we just let our markets go and technology become unleashed, we'll fix it.
Well, the way I look at it is it seems like technology is unleashed. We're not holding anybody back. You know, we're making weird stuff with Petri dishes and growing them on our fields as we speak. And yet, even those agricultural scientists are on the forefront. I mean, I talked to one researcher who was the head of the genetics department at Oxford University, who's now working on this thing called C4 rice. It's gotten a huge amount of funding from Bill and Melinda Gates. It's the only thing out there that really has the potential to increase rice yields by up to 50% without adding lots of inputs or anything else. It's the only thing out there now that can really boom yields. And what they're talking about is creating a whole new rice plant through new cell architecture. I mean, it's high tech stuff. It's 20 years out. You know, we're going to need something a lot sooner than 20 years. And if we can't grow enough food or diversify our diets enough or limit the amount of you know, grain-centric meats and vegetables and dairy that we consume, then we're going to have to reduce our demand somehow.
Well, and that and so you look at that too. One of the ways that you think we can, in the shorter run, maybe solve some of this problem, at least our need for protein, is with fish farming. Is that right?
I'm a big fan of sustainable aquaculture. Now, there's a lot of aquaculture that's been done poorly, and we've seen it over the last, you know, the Blue Revolution that was launched sort of in the 70s came with a lot of the same warts that the Green Revolution had: disease, antibiotics, escapement, pollution of these fish farms the size of small towns. You know, it's just incredible. But a few years ago, I went and looked at a lot of the new fish farms that are really operating on the cutting edge, where they're promoting and growing a lot of fish food, I mean, a lot of fish protein, healthy omega-3 protein, with very little impact on the environment. Some of these guys are going offshore in deep offshore waters called the oligotrophic zone, with very low nutrients, where anything that comes out of the fish is scavenged almost immediately by primary producers. Other guys are growing these multitrophic fish farms where they're growing one fed species of fish and growing shellfish and kelp all around it, creating sort of this ancient Chinese heirloom garden, if you will. And of course, just simply growing shellfish is a wonderful way to produce protein that actually cleans water of nutrients and sediments instead of polluting it. Of course, ocean acidification could have a potentially tremendous impact on shellfish production, which would be a crying shame because it's one of the great types of food production that's blessed by almost everyone.
Well, what about, you also said that if we don't, you know, do something about climate change, we're going to lose all this land. But I've also read that it is too late, that the coyote has already, coyote's off the cliff. We're just waiting for that slide whistle before he falls into the Acme bomb in the valley below.
Well, you know, I love bringing up Malthus quotes, but, you know, he said, misery does not exist to create despair. It exists to compel us to our utmost activity. So, you know, the reason this book exists is because I want to compel people to the utmost activity to try to solve this issue. We have a short window. I don't think it's closed quite yet. And I do believe that technology exists and that young kids are out there who are going to find it, that will enable us to reduce our carbon emissions, you know, without taking the economy back to the Neanderthal age. I mean, we've already seen countries in Europe that have had wonderful growth and reducing their carbon at the same time, reducing their carbon emissions. So it's completely possible.
So some behavioral change can sort of take us back from the edge and maybe slow climate growth. A little bit of the change in the industry, sustainable fish farming, that sort of thing. What about the economic changes? Again, we get to this business of saying, well, these corporations have ultimately control over these ecosystems, and then we end up paying the price. We socialize the price. But you have had experience and talked with experts in Scandinavia about drilling. Because you also covered the BP oil spill, the deepwater spill. What's been your experience there? Are there ways of developing resources, mineral resources, that aren't as extractive and that do sort of we all benefit by this?
Well, I'm currently working on a story on this great push to extract resources from the Arctic because of the climate is melting the Arctic twice as fast. You know, the temperature is rising twice as fast there as elsewhere on the planet. It's opening up this huge, vast area, which could contain as much as 20% of the world's hydrocarbon. So, Norway, social democratic country, everything is very controlled and restricted. They see these natural resources as belonging to the sovereign people of Norway. And so they allow companies, some of them state-owned, like Statoil, other ones are private industry, to come in and, under very strict regulation to tap those resources safely with the input from the unions. They view it as this sort of tripartite government, company, union sort of arrangement, where everybody benefits and no one gets hurt.
A lot of worker protections, right?
A lot of worker protections. They haven't had a blowout there since the 80s. And during the BP spill, I interviewed the head of their Petroleum Directorate Society, their governing body, regulatory body, and asked him, you know, would this type of deep water horizon well be allowed to drill off the Norwegian coast? And he was, absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have three barriers between the reservoir and the rig. And they did not do that in the BP spill.
What about the profits? Who?
Well, there's an interesting division, and this is how it was explained to me, is that here we have a sort of auction for these lease blocks off the coast. Norway, they say, look, we will let you drill for free. However, you'll have to follow our rules. You'll have to hire our folks. And at the end of the day, we're going to tax you for 75% of whatever you make. You get to keep 25%. The people of Norway get to keep 75%. And that sounds egregious. However, the companies still operate up there. They still seem to make a profit. And in the meantime, Norwegian people have great schools, great health care, all these social benefits.
They're not living in slavery, miserable people in gray commons with bad haircuts.
They seem to be quite among the happiest, as well as some of the most industrious people I've ever met. They're just they seem to be a very happy society.
So far, things are going pretty well for them. And the companies haven't left, as you said. They didn't all flee with this 75% tax. So they're still drilling. And they're still making money. Now, one more question. Can we feed ourselves going forward without genetic modification? Can we do this through organic grass?
This is the big question. And I think people are rightly afraid of genetic modification. But so far, the GMOs that are on the market have not caused widespread either environmental or health impacts, despite people's many fears. Neither have they created great yield gains or they've created some environmental benefits from soil erosion and from a reduced use of more toxic pesticides. Absolutely good things. But they haven't really solved this big problem. The problem is, though, we're so addicted to it, as we were speaking earlier. We're so addicted to cheap grain, and our population is so high that to throw any powerful tool, such as genetic modification, out the window and sort of say we can't use that because we don't want to go there, even though we're going there in almost every other field, medicine, you name it, I think would be the height of foolishness, just because our demand and our need for something that will solve both the environmental and the yield issue is going to have to come from somewhere.
Do you think organic practices have more or less reached their peak? In other words, it will always remain a kind of a niche, or can it really be part of the problem and scaled up?
The coolest thing about organic, and I think it really is, the organic farmers have a lot to teach the conventional guys, because the more they dig into it, the more researchers find that this interaction between plants and the soil is critical. And the more fungi and the more life you have in the soil, the more nutrients, the more microbes, the more healthy and robust and, the crops. So one of the ag researchers said, talked to me, once we dig down to this sort of relationship between root fibers of the crops we love and need and the microorganisms of the soil, we're talking postmodern agriculture.
Which is very pre-modern, and it could trump a convention that began in, I think, 1948. That's when conventional agriculture began.
Well, my great example is this poor Indian rice farmer a few years ago who blew away the rice yield record that was held by the most famous rice scientist in Japan by using this blend of both organic techniques and good seeds. So by using the best of both worlds, I think we can go a long way toward both solving our environmental issues and feeding everybody.
All right, Joel, you've given me hope. I hold you responsible for this. Joel Bourne, nature reporter, contributing writer for National Geographic. His newest book is called The End of Plenty, and you can find out more about that program and Joel's readings. In fact, he's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham Wednesday at 7 o'clock. I can tell you that right now. But if you missed it, as always, go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.